stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Sunday morning. It is not Rick Moore. It is Sean McCord on a lovely Sunday in late November. What is going on here? You're on the wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Sean McCord, and my guest this morning is Siva Vaidyanathan. Siva, my friend, my neighbor, my constant Facebook friend. We both work at the university, which I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Sean. This is it's a nice opportunity, and I look forward to free-ranging conversation.
A free-ranging conversation indeed, because you and I sometimes get into it on Facebook, and I felt like, you know what, let's bring that in here and talk about issues that interest us. You are the, and let me get this right, you are the Robertson Professor of Media Studies and Law.
Yeah, I don't do the law thing anymore.
You don't do the law thing anymore. Yeah. Okay, all right. Then somebody has to update your Wikipedia page.
Yes.
but you teach media studies at the University of Virginia. Actually, let's just start with that. Tell me, what is media studies?
Well, it's plural, right? Media mm-hmm. and studies are both plural. So what are media studies?
Media studies?
Yeah, the media studies department is about a decade old, 9.5 years old. It, mm-hmm. it was created when I arrived here from NYU in 2007. It had been a program at UVA for about a decade earlier. A program, the difference in a program and a department is a program can't do its own hiring, but it exists as a major for students. And the idea when the College of Arts and Sciences decided to start a media studies program and then make it into a department was that students could approach the study of media from historical, theoretical, philosophical, ethical, as well as practical sides, examine media from the full range of liberal arts approaches, to do it in an interdisciplinary way, to do it in a publicly engaged way. And UVA, of course, being UVA, was not going to do what other universities do. We were not going to set up a communication or a journalism department that takes a very production-based approach. If you want that, there are lots of fine places where one could attend school, but to go to UVA is to enter an intellectual world, one in which students are invited to explore broadly, to explore globally, to explore historically, all the different ways that any phenomena affect life on Earth. So, for the same way that our excellent religious studies department sends students through a wide array of approaches to the study of religion, historical, anthropological, literary, theological, media studies let students ultimately decide what aspects of the media world they're most interested in. And for many students, that's film. For other students, it's journalism. For other students, it might be social media. Regardless of that, students get a core understanding of how media from the printing press through the internet have affected our lives.
Well, two media questions come to mind, and that is, you said the department has existed for about 10 years. So you are the Robertson. So that's an endowed professorship,
right?
And this is a. Your students are undergraduates.
That's right. We have yet to produce a graduate program or build a graduate mm-hmm. program. We're in the process of that.
Oh, interesting. Good. Yeah. I didn't know that. So that's something I want to hear more about. So when your students come in, I mean, they're undergraduate students, so they're young.
Right.
What is their sense of history already? And especially with the advent of social media, how much has the program changed over the 10 years?
I think the program's changed more than the students have, actually.
Yeah.
So, look, there are students and then there are UVA students.
Right.
The UVA students come in, even if they lack historical depth, they arrive with historical curiosity, or they wouldn't have picked the University of Virginia. No one picks the University of Virginia because they aren't aware of the deep roots that the institution has in the world and the influence that the thought of founders like Thomas Jefferson have had on the world, both positive and negative. So we're lucky that we get students who may have been deprived of historical perspective in middle school and high school, as most American students are, but they don't want to remain deprived. Mm. So that doesn't mean the curriculum stays the same. I think it's safe to say that in our department, media studies, we re-examine our curriculum more often and more significantly than most other departments. We've gone through two major curricular revisions since I've been here, and we do constant iterations every year because everything changes. When I was hired in 2007, I was the primary and often only professor in what was then a department of six who taught courses on digital subjects. I taught a big survey class called Introduction to Digital Media. Just a couple years ago, we all sat around and finally had to come to the conclusion that what's the distinction? Why are we teaching a class on digital media? What's not digital media?
Exactly.
We don't teach an introduction to analog media, although perhaps we should. That would maybe be a more interesting course. And what we were doing with that class was trying to take a semester-long survey where we walked through a variety of issues that digital media raise in our lives. The ability, the ease through which digital media are manipulated and remixed and re-edited, the low barriers to entry to production of digital media, the very notion of what a computer is and what a computer does and what it can't do. Mm-hmm. Computers in their both simplicity and complexity. And we would talk about copyright issues, and we would talk about privacy issues, and we would talk about security issues, and we would talk about the larger cultural issues. And the issues started proliferating so much that class, we just kept packing more into that class. And I was the one teaching it most of the time, and it was driving me a bit crazy. And I refused to teach the same course every semester. A lot of professors get the luxury of preparing for a course and teaching it along, 90% of the same lines for years, sometimes even decades. Right? Organic chemistry changes every decade or so, but, right, usually in the methods of teaching rather than the core subject matter. But I refused to do that because it would be irresponsible. Every year, I would change more than half of the reading list. Every year, I would change the subject. I remember the first time I taught it in the fall of 2007, the first time I taught it at UVA, I think I did a week on social media. And it was, 2007, that's when Facebook was just breaking beyond the usage in colleges and universities into the public. It was the moment at which people beyond college and university environments were invited in to the Facebook world. And so social media seemed in 2007 to be of rising importance, but we weren't really sure of the nature of its implications.
Sure.
There were a lot of people dismissing it as cotton candy, and there were a lot of people lauding its revolutionary potential. And I tried to guide my students into a pretty critical position on both of those polls. I think we've been warranted in that. However, within 2 years, more than a third of the class was taken up by social media and its various permutations. And of course, boy, spring of 2011, that was quite a time. I had a whole semester mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden in, January 20th, 2011, riots break out in Cairo.
Right.
By the end of February, there are new governments in Tunisia and Egypt, and riots breaking out in Morocco and Syria and Bahrain. In addition to the lesser known riots and protests going on the northern side of the Mediterranean, and so I had to scrap the entire syllabus and have my students examine the rhetoric that was pouring out of our cable news networks, but also the sort of self-congratulatory rhetoric pouring out of Facebook and Twitter, in which there were these really facile examinations of the effect of social media on those demonstrations, those riots, those protests, and ultimately the overthrows of the government. And I wanted my, this was a perfect opportunity for my students to go deep and to get a sense of what we could actually discern in terms of the relationship between and among media systems and movements, social and political movements. How much do we assume that a phenomenon like Twitter has a profound effect? How much of that assumption is based on the fact that we like to congratulate ourselves for spending hours on Twitter? You know,
yeah.
is there an element of techno-narcissism at work, which is actually what I believe, that in fact, you know, you spend hours following stuff on Twitter, you get all your information from it, and you want to be patted on the back or pat yourself on the back for being involved in this medium that you can now convince yourself played a central role in events around the world, when in fact there's really no evidence that it was of causal importance. I remember tweeting out something in those days, of course, tweeted it, right? Mm-hmm. Human beings use commonly available communication device, you know, like breaking. Human beings use commonly available, like, no kidding, you know, like if they had had other communication devices, they would have, as they did, right? So people throughout those movements and demonstrations and protests and riots used flyers that they produced on copy machines. They used SMS text messaging. They used the telephone while it worked. They used Facebook and Twitter while they worked. But mostly people were using Twitter to reach beyond their home countries. Twitter was the way to get news out from countries like Tunisia, where there were almost no journalists. There were a handful of European journalists, a few French journalists. BBC was there. But, you know, there were very few journalists to cover what was going on there. And yet, it was a major story in the world. How many Americans had thought about the regime of Ben Ali before that moment? How many have thought about it since? But, you know, what we were relying on was Twitter to learn about what was going down. But that didn't mean that people in Tunisia or Egypt or any of those other countries that we tend to ignore because the revolutions didn't quite work out, were actually using Twitter among themselves. Almost nobody. And the fact that in Egypt, the internet itself was down for more than a week during the central parts of the protests is often ignored in the laudatory thing. So what we end up with 2011. So I scrap my syllabus and wing it. Right.
Sure.
And that same spring, I don't know if you remember, like that spring break, all my students come back from spring break after we had talked through as much as we could gather. And I brought in, I had experts on the Middle East and North Africa come in and do Skype visits to my class to talk about what they actually knew was going on or could find out what was going on. And we talked about different media systems. And one of the things we started hearing over and over again was the crucial importance of Al Jazeera in getting people in different countries to recognize what was going on in other countries. So when things seemed to be going well in Tunisia and Egypt, that really emboldened protesters in Morocco and Bahrain, two countries that, again, the United States was not paying any attention to. And those were the sorts of insights we were able to get in a classroom setting by bringing in experts who are actually plugged into those countries. And so we started to get this idea that, you know, maybe we're talking about Al Jazeera enabled protests much more than Facebook or Twitter. But of course, that's not sexy, right? Oh, you know, global satellite network, you know, that's so 1980s,
yeah.
Right? That's, or, you know, so 1989, right?
I'm old enough to remember when the revolution will be televised.
Yes, exactly.
And now it's when the revolution will be tweeted.
Right. And the fact is, television still mattered centrally, as it still does in so many people's lives. And if you go to any of those countries in North Africa, the first thing you notice, before you notice the minarets on the mosques, is a proliferation of satellite dishes. That is how people get news of the world. That is how people follow soccer. That's mm-hmm. why throughout North Africa, everyone's wearing, you know, Messi and Neymar jerseys, because they are so plugged into the world through Al Jazeera and through other satellite networks that are coming through, including some Rupert Murdoch-owned networks like Star TV that send soccer games globally, right? Those are important phenomena that we forget about or we ignore as Americans, because we would rather not try to examine how people on the ground in their houses, homes, and communities are experiencing media and using it to forge identity, using it to distinguish themselves from the world, using it to motivate themselves the same way we do, right? So, I mean, the same way we use standard television on top of Facebook, on top of Twitter, on top of whatever else we're using, on top of community talk radio shows like this one to do all of that work.
The Progressive Voice of Charlotte.
Right, right. So that semester was a beautiful lab, but it was also, as you might imagine, terrifying for me, right?
Yeah.
I was flying without a syllabus. I mean, I still had the same papers due on the same dates and the same requirements to succeed in the class, but the subject matter was on the fly. We all come back from spring break, and all my students could talk about was this video they had seen, this long video they had seen called Kony 2012.
Yeah.
Right? Where, yes. And this was, remember, spring of 2011, sure. Where they had all seen this thing about how children were dying in South Central Africa, and there was this dude named Kony who was responsible, and how these... this, you know, group of white people in America were banging on doors in Congress to try to get congressional leaders and President Obama to recognize the threat that this guy Kony has and to make him a phenomenon and a factor in the ensuing year running up to the 2012 election, so he would be an issue in the world. Well, again, perfect experiment. So, like, then the next the post spring break part of the semester, I had to rewrite. And bring in people who were experts on Africa through Skype visits and talk about the role of YouTube and then get to the bottom of what is this group doing and what are they trying to accomplish here. And I'm doing this with 250 students. So it's not like some seminar where we're all sort of exploring as a group in a sort of comfortable conversational environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was weird. But that's the sort of stuff we do in media studies because – everything we seem to touch is so crucial, or everything we touch seems so crucial, something like that, right? And sometimes it's really hard in the moment to distinguish the frosting from the cake or the fleetingly interesting from the deeply important. That's our job, to help students make those distinctions. Sometimes we get it wrong, but that's why a scholarly field like media studies exists. It's not just to launch students on careers in media, although we do that quite successfully and we're quite proud of that. But we want students who go into the media businesses or not to understand that there are tools, there are bodies of knowledge, there are habits of mind that can help you distinguish the fleetingly interesting from the deeply important.
My guest, who is making my job way too easy, is Steve Evadia Nathan, Robertson Professor of Media Studies at UVA. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord. My guest is Steve Evadia Nathan. Steve, your students, you were talking about 2011 and your 250 students and how they were able to examine a larger world events through this, I want to say microscope, but that's not right. Sort of this macroscope,
yes.
of social media, of media in general. But I mean, media, what we think of as traditional media and now social media are so intertwined. We've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram. Some of it is genuine social media, but like my understanding is, and you can correct me, is that Twitter has sort of become the home of journalists, and less dominated by, I mean, sure, you know, Coca-Cola and 7-Eleven have Twitter accounts,
right.
But who subscribes to those,
right?
Except maybe as a joke.
We could look it up and see how many followers Coca-Cola has. I wonder who these people are.
Yeah, yeah,
you have
exactly
to actively follow Coca-Cola. Like,
yeah, right.
That
and that's kind of the beauty of Twitter, is that you actually have to actively follow.
Yeah.
But I also wonder about the language of social media.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I said sort of laughingly, the revolution will be tweeted, but just right there. It sounds kind of light and airy and bird-like, and yet become a very, you know, it's become a critical tool of communication. So, but I know a lot of sort of people who aren't in the media. I'm talking about, you know, frankly, people in my generation and older who won't take Twitter seriously because it's named Twitter. Your students, now acknowledging that UVA students are already a cut above.
Right.
But do you find that this generation of students to be savvy media consumers?
No Americans are savvy media consumers before they major in media studies at the University of Virginia.
It's what makes them savvy media consumers.
So here's the thing. I actually don't believe there's such a thing as generations. We can get into that if you want, but that would take about 10 minutes. When I said that the subject matter has changed faster than my students have, or more than my students have, that's one of the more interesting observations I've made in my 20 years in this business. And what I mean by that is when students come to us with vastly different levels of preparation and knowledge, right? So they're all talented, which is how you get into UVA.
Sure.
But they're all very different in terms of what they actually know when they come in the door and what they actually understand when they come in the door. Some of them went to some of the finest public high schools of Northern Virginia. Others went to the best high school they could find in the coal fields of Southwest Virginia. Some of them came from Denmark. Some of them came from Kenya, right? So when you have that kind of diversity, when you have and believe me, we don't have the diversity we wish we had. But nonetheless, in any class of 100 students, you're going to find five who didn't own a personal computer in their home growing up, right? Mm. You're going to find a handful who to this day have actively resisted being part of Facebook. And you're going to find a number who can break into your phone in 5 minutes, right? So the difference in skill level, in knowledge, and in understanding, and in savvy is vast, and it is as vast as any group that you take in the population, which is one of the reasons I think the notion of examining these issues by generation doesn't hold up to scrutiny. The diversity among any age cohort in anything is far greater than the differences you might average out between 35-year-olds and 70-year-olds, or 15-year-olds and 35-year-olds. So that's just one small part of the reason I forbid my students from using that term in class, because it lends itself to the most facile examinations.
So noted.
I'm not grading you. I mean,
I am now one of your students, as are all my listeners.
Yeah, because it's a great way to avoid talking about things like family wealth, whether you had a public library in your neighborhood growing up, whether you grew up in the Rio Grande Valley or Appalachia or the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Those things matter more than the year you were born. And so what I see, though, is in most cases, and this is not at all an age thing, this is across the board, because our interaction with rich and interesting forms of media, both production and consumption, is too easy now.
Right.
So get this, right? Every once in a while you'll hear a parent or a grandparent say, "Oh my God, my kid just blew me away. Like, my 3-year-old picked up my iPad and just started using it. Like, he knew, like, he was born with that. Like, what's up with that?" And I was like, "Well, that's because it's designed for a 3-year-old, right? They explicitly designed it so a 3-year-old would be enchanted by it and find it comforting and easy to use. Like, they know what they're doing, right? These are the most brilliant engineers in the world who are designing the interface. So, of course, the MS-DOS you used in 1985 was going to drive you crazy and would take weeks to master, if not years to master, mm-hmm. right? And you would mm-hmm. still make mistakes mm-hmm. because they had neither the processing capability nor the code base to work with. And the whole community of engineers was lurching toward what would ultimately become this completely intuitive graphical user interface, which is kind of an archaic term. In fact, it goes beyond graphical now, right?
Right.
I don't know what this interface is, but and this is before we put on the big goggles, which are coming next, right? So when you think about it that way, right, one of the many problems with these interfaces, the interface on your phone, the interface on your tablet, even the interface on your laptop right now, is that it's so easy that we disappear into it and we assume, and they're so thin, right? These objects are so thin that we think of them as magic and we just accept it. We do not dig into the fact that there is complex machinery in there, that electricity does some amazing things within that box, but more importantly, that human hands assembled that. And some people lost their hands in the assembly of that, right?
Which is another topic.
Yeah.
Yes.
But like, so what I try to get my students to understand is the amazing human effort, labor, ingenuity, investment, risk, damage, high costs that went into these things that we now attach to our bodies for so many hours a day. I try to demystify it for them. And so they are in the habit of demystifying these technologies and they see the human hands in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. So in terms of their savvy, one of the things that I try to get them to understand is how little they understand. That they're capable of setting up an iPad and configuring it within an hour of opening the box is not impressive. You know, if you can learn a couple of programming languages over a period of months or years, and you can design something for that box, I'm impressed.
Okay.
Okay. But to use it is not impressive because they have been designed for 3-year-olds.
Right.
Right. So, so that's a really important distinction. But the other things, you know, I try to overturn, you know, use the available social science, and there's much of it, but it never really gets out into the public discussion, to overturn some common myths. Like I teach a class on privacy and surveillance. And one of the things we try to do is, first of all, define what we mean by privacy and what we mean by surveillance, but also explode this myth that young people don't care about privacy, when in fact, every bit of evidence shows that young people care much more about privacy than old people do. And, you know, you follow my mom's Facebook feed. There's all kinds of stuff she shouldn't be putting out there, right? it makes me turn red every once in a while, right? Yeah. But at the same time, that's not really what we're talking about with privacy. We're talking about the ability to control one's reputation in a variety of contexts and be able to contextualize your world and how people learn about you. Something that was quite intuitive and fairly easy to do before Facebook came around and scrambled all of our contacts,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's what we're trying to get to here. But in fact, every study shows that that most young people in the United States are quite aware of and concerned with their modes of presentation, which is why, I mean, think about you as a young person. You cared much more about your hair than you do now. You still look like a young person, so not to take that away from you, but you know,
back then when I had hair,
exactly. So yeah. Look, that's what's going to happen, right? When of course, you cared more about your self presentation at 15 or 18
because you're terribly self conscious,
right? Yeah. You're terribly self conscious, and you know you're entering these new social contexts, and you know there's a lot at stake in every one of these new social contexts, academic, professional, social, sexual, whatever it is. You are in the mode like. That anxiety that so many of us had at that age was driven by that inarticulated, often unacknowledged, but fully consuming process of forging our images and identities in these various contexts. And imagine how terrifying it would have been and how much more terrifying it is now to have those contexts scrambled. So that what your coach knows about you, what your clergy member knows about you, and what your best friends know about you, and what your cousins know about you, and what your parents know about you, are all being forced into this one funnel of social media, and everything's at risk. Like, so you and I had the advantage of being able to segregate the information people knew about us in those contexts.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone abrogated trust within those contexts, we could shun that person and say, that person betrayed me, right? And there were ways of dealing with it. But you force everything through Facebook, and oh my gosh, at that point, you have to step in and actively, I don't know if you've done this, but I've done this to a degree, actively segregate your collection of Facebook friends. I'm using air quotes here on the radio, right? Facebook friends, so that certain information doesn't reach the wrong people, you know? And that takes a lot of work, and like much more work than it does in real life.
Sure.
So that's actually what we're seeing right now.
You use the term techno narcissism, which I hadn't heard before, but I rather
I made it up.
You made it up. Yeah. Well, it's a hashtag techno narcissism.
You can stick techno in front of almost anything, and it sounds like you're smart. So
your students now in 2016,
yeah.
How you mentioned 2011 and the Arab Spring and what was going on there, and how this was an opportunity to both learn what was going on and learning about the ways it was being conveyed. That was 5 years ago. We're in 2016 now. And a different, I don't want to use the word generation, but a different cohort of students coming with a different set of experiences. how plugged into are they? What are they talking about that's going on in the larger world? Yeah. And how? And I want to use this word again. Savvy are they? I mean, if we're Facebook friends, you may have seen that I've had a rather long discussion the past couple of days about what's going on in the North Dakota pipeline.
Yes.
Basically, I was aware of this story. It was kind of happening on the fringes, but I really hadn't dived deep into it because you may be aware there were one or two other things going on in the news.
Yeah,
they were kind of just shouting. He's like, okay, so rather than go and look it up, I just said to my friends, hey, what's this about and why should I care? And this discussion is still going on. And as we speak, I'm sure if I picked up my phone, I'm still getting lots of links and videos and kind of sorry I opened up that door. But the reason I asked that is because it kind of felt like, Coney.
Yeah.
I almost said Comey. Kind of like Coney in 2011. It kind of, this is what we should be outraged about now.
Yeah.
Without even necessarily knowing what it's all about,
right.
And knowing one side of it. So, what are your students talking about now? And are they getting sort of the full spectrum of information, or are they just as inclined to kind of be outraged about whatever we're supposed to be outraged about this week?
So this is interesting. I'm about to write a book, actually, about Facebook and how it's affected our political lives.
And does it have a title yet?
It has a bunch of bad titles that have run around in my head. A title's always the hardest thing to write, but I don't know. If I had to pick one today, it would actually be anti-social media.
Nice.
I just decided to write this book in the past few days. And I've turned out a proposal, and I'm pitching it to publishers this week. If there are any publishers listening, keep an eye out. So here's the deal. What are my students thinking about? So here's long ago, I decided not to be involved with any current students on Facebook. This was a decision I made in the dawn of Facebook, back when Facebook was only available to university people. I was one of the first members of Facebook from NYU because I had heard about it, sort of trickling down from the Ivies. And so I joined early. And of course, most of my students in those days were using Facebook almost exclusively for sort of social and romantic
liaisons.
They hoped, you know, futility perhaps, but whatever it was, it was not stuff I had any business knowing about or interacting with. And I also have long felt it's best for students not to know anything about or know as little as possible about my social life and my family life, or know only what I want them to know in context.
Sure. So
I will tell them stories about my daughter doing something cute or funny or something relevant to the class. I will tell them stories about my dog. I will say, well, and then my wife told me I'm stupid for thinking this, right? And, you know, those sorts of stories will come out. But again, only when they're precisely chosen by me. I don't want them to be in that part of my world. So long ago, I decided that they won't be part of my Facebook world. Mm-hmm. Many of them follow me on Twitter, and I follow many of them on Twitter because it's a different set of norms going on there. So I couldn't tell you what students are absorbed with, let's just say, get it out there, for the last 2.5 weeks, right? As we have been so absorbed with, well, what's the future of our country
and whether
our neighbors are going to be physically threatened as they have been. Those concerns, I'm confident, are their concerns. I have had students in my office talking to me about the repercussions of the election. I have had students write to me and say, can we do something so that faculty and students can think through the implications of this election together? And I've been hesitant to engage at that level, largely because I don't feel savvy myself.
Right? Fair enough.
So how savvy are any of us? Who am I to judge whether my 21-year-old student is savvy about the world right now, when I feel so incapable, so naive, so exposed, so bewildered by the decisions of my neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, not that many neighbors in Charlottesville, but 20 miles beyond, yes. And like everybody, some members of my family, right? I mean, just
sure.
to be so,
yeah, I got those.
Like, how in the world do we live in the same country in the world and have this little mutual understanding about basic facts, conditions, opportunities, justice, decency? How is that possible, right? So I know that my job, whether I was a media studies, whether I'm a media studies professor or some other kind of professor, my job is to be able to step back and actually ask that question bluntly: how is this possible, and where can we go with it? And I guarantee you my students are asking the same question. So in my back and forth with some students over email over this, where they were talking about, can we do some event? And at first they wanted to get a bunch of professors from a bunch of different parts of the university to talk about the implications of the election. I said, well, do you really want to do a postmortem, or do you want to talk among media studies students, who I'm mostly interested in hearing from, sure. and a few faculty, about what sort of media system should we build, right? UVA students are destined, privileged to help forge the next media ecosystem in this country. What will be the operational principles and practices that they want to bring to it? That's what I'm interested in. I don't have an answer today, but it's my duty to find out what they can and are willing to do over the next few years, help guide them toward that. And when I say guide them, I don't mean guide them to the point where a liberal candidate could win. That's not the goal. That would be irresponsible of me, as much as I would like that to happen in the world for the sake of my daughter and my neighbors and everybody. But it's much more that we're stuck with this quasi-democratic republic. We are stuck with the neighbors who see things so differently, the family members we see so differently. You know, as much as people talk about segregation and bubbles, we aren't as bubbled as we pretend to be or assume what we are, right? Forever, you know, like, people in Manhattan are a ferry ride away from Staten Island, which went 70% for Trump. So, like, nobody in this country is really in a bubble, at least a geographic bubble. But every one of us is in some sort of intellectual and information bubble. And all these bubbles are interlocking, right? You can be in the vaccine denial bubble and the climate denial bubble and the white supremacist bubble. And those are distinct bubbles, and there are intersections there. But, you know, and then there are people who are in the anti-vaccine bubble and the, you know, radical left bubble and the, you know, and some other bubble, right? And there are intersecting bubbles there. So what is the contour of our intellectual and information world? What are the dynamics? What is possible? Because the assumptions of the Enlightenment that we have been carrying with us as our foundation for 400 years now, have always been at risk. They've always been tenuous. They've always been fragile. In the United States, I don't know that they've ever been, well, okay, I take that back. They haven't been so fully exposed since I showed up 50 years ago. Look, the Civil War is a pretty big challenge to the Enlightenment, right? So given that in my lifetime, 50 years, we've reached the point where the very notion that we might actually be able to have most Americans and most of our leaders agree on the basic tenets of fair play and decency, and most of our citizens and most of our leaders agree on some basic facts about the world, that seems harder to achieve in 2016 than it even did in 1966. I'm making no such claim about the level of racism. I have no illusion that the level of racism in 1966 was so much higher than it is today, that the level of sexism, the level of homophobia, all of which are so much better today than they were in 1966 when I was born. But nonetheless, in that process of achieving real movements toward justice in all those areas, we have created a counter-revolution, a counter-reformation, a counter-enlightenment. We've allowed it to and fostered it, and now it's growing to the point where it's really openly threatening not just people's lives, which there's always been this sort of violent effort in America that has threatened people's safety and lives if they didn't choose to live the mainstream way or through no fault of their own didn't live the mainstream way. But now we're at the point where we have our polis seems incapable of managing that. Part of that is that one of our two political parties lost its ability to filter out nonsense.
Yes.
So what is the role of our media world in that? And the reason I'm writing this book about Facebook is I think Facebook is largely, or let's say significantly, to blame. Just like Facebook scrambled our social contexts, Facebook has scrambled our ability to discern good information from bad. And it has, at the same time, sorted us into indignant tribes. It's also, while providing links to rich sources of information, just like it provides you rich sources of information to what's going on in the Dakotas right now, it also allows us to traffic in the shallowest headline-based reactions, some of which are complete BS. So I'm trying to get my head around that, and I know that that's a major concern of my students. So that's kind of where we're headed right now.
My guest, stuck in a bubble with me, is Siva Vaidyanathan. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord with my guest, Siva Vaidyanathan. Siva, you were talking about we're in a post-election phase now. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people where you go, well, there was 2.5 weeks ago, and then there's now. I work at the university. I work in the library. And I will confess, and I'm not proud of this, but prior to a few weeks ago, I was one of those who might have turned my nose up a little at the idea of safe spaces.
Right.
Because, you know, college is supposed to be a place where you go, where your ideas are challenged, and you learn to sort of develop those muscles and defend yourself. But I, like a lot of people in this town, like a lot of people who work at the university, woke up that Wednesday morning. Actually, I say woke up, really not having slept the night before, completely bewildered and stunned and gobsmacked. And my employer, the University of Virginia Library, God bless them for doing this, wanted to provide a space for students to come in and just talk,
right.
Just sit down and talk with each other, talk with staff members, talk with faculty. We provided a safe space where these students were coming in. And I mean, we had young people coming in. I was sitting at a table with the president of the university on one side and the provost on the other. And I give them so much credit for doing that. And young people coming in, sitting across the table from us, and they were just struck. I mean, they had tears in their eyes because they woke up, like so many of us, and discovered that they didn't live in the country that they thought they did.
Yes.
That it wasn't just about losing an election. I mean, sure, maybe they're young, maybe this, you know, they may have come from, they knew one president for the past 8 years. Maybe they hadn't had the experience of losing an election before, but this wasn't just that.
Right.
This was discovering, getting hit in the gut that your neighbors, that your community, that family members supported a movement that traded on fear and hatred and stereotypes and we've got this to look forward to for the next 4 years. So I completely changed my mind on what a safe space is. Sure,
yeah.
The university itself doesn't need to be a safe space, but we need to provide areas where people can come in.
Well, let's think about what safe means, right?
Yes, please.
I mean, safe, so I think that the cartoon version of safe spaces is one of the biggest lies perpetrated by a combination of right-wing enemies of universities and left-wing tough talkers who are liberal, at least, not necessarily left-wing, but liberal tough talkers, almost none of whom have taught undergraduates in the last 50 years or ever, right?
Exactly my point.
So there's that. What is a safe space? A safe space is a place one can go where one can be confident to be taken seriously, where one can be confident that one will be respected, where one can be confident one will not be dismissed, insulted, or threatened by someone who thinks less of that person because of some factor of identity. Okay? We all want that. Who doesn't want that?
Right?
If you, so this is why the idea of safe space is being applied against or counter put forth as a problem or something that works against intellectual engagement or intellectual freedom is absurd. It's the exact opposite. Safe spaces make intellectual engagement, intellectual freedom, the serious consideration of dissenting ideas possible. You cannot engage with someone who disagrees with you about actual ideas, not epithets,
right,
not insults, but actual ideas, if you don't have an agreement, a protocol, a sense of safety with that person and with the people you're operating with. Right. So every classroom has always aspired to be a safe space. Every professor's office has aspired to be a safe space. They haven't always been. They haven't always been. We're being explicit about it now because we want people with different views of the world, different experiences, different opinions, to be able to engage with each other intelligently, respectfully, calmly, without anyone feeling lessened by that process, reduced, infantilized, rejected, insulted, threatened. And believe me, I've seen all of that happen. But one of the reasons I work in the business I work in, one of the reasons I do my job, is that the university is one of the few places left in the world where people can actually do that work because it's safe. Now, there are other versions of safe spaces. One that's certain versions that seem exclusive, and those exist for a reason, because even within the ideal of providing a set of protocols and understandings that we can disagree, because it doesn't always happen, because there are faculty members who will dismiss a transgender student or be disgusted by a transgender student, and there are students who will be angry, threatened, even violent toward a gay student. Because there are students and faculty and staff, occasionally university police officers, who will who will voice indignation toward members of a university community. We also operate, or at least label or boast of, places where you can come to breathe, where you can come to step back from the turmoil and know that you can just find support. So think of the Women's Center.
Mm-hmm.
Think of many faculty offices that are around the university that have rainbow stickers on their windows. That's an explicit statement that, like, when the turmoil of the outside world is dragging on you, you got a friend here. Now, every adult in the United States has those spaces without the rainbow flags. Every adult has those spaces. It's a friend's house. It's a bar. It's a barbershop. It's a church. We all have those spaces. We just don't label them that. Mm-hmm. But that's where you go when the world starts really pushing on you. Now, look, at 50, I seek out those spaces, right? And maybe listening to the show is one of those comforting moments. It's not really a space, but it's an engagement with people who are generally of like mind and unlikely to be threatened.
Nice plug. Thank
so,
you.
So that you, that, but that's why we do it, right? I mean, I'm sure that many of the people listening to us right now are listening because they love the affirmation that we're giving them for what they already think. That can't be their whole life. It shouldn't be anybody's whole life, right? You should also spend a good portion of your life engaging with people who don't agree with what you say, but
that's what Thanksgiving is for.
Yeah, right. But we need both of those. We need all of that, because nobody has the strength and resilience to live in that moment of intellectual battle all the time. And because people do cross the line, because we're human beings at the university. So that's why these things are so important. Now, when you and I were undergraduates, no such idea existed in an explicit way.
It's true.
And we know, and you and I both know people who could have stuck it out if they didn't feel so constantly threatened, if they didn't feel so constantly dismissed, disrespected in that environment, that we idealize in many, many cases for good reason, for being the one part of this country where you shouldn't have to always be on guard, right? So we would love to continue to make the university a place where people of all backgrounds and people of all political persuasions can feel comfortable and secure that they are going to be respected and not dismissed. And we have a long way to go. And I know I have a lot of work to do as a professor who likes to think that that's how I behave, but I don't always behave that way, right? We all have to constantly examine it. And every time I see the rainbow sticker outside of my colleague's office, it gives me a moment to say, have I been as good a person as I would like to be? Have I been as supportive? Have I been as comforting? Have I been as responsible as I would like to, as I know my colleague has been? It gives me an ability to check myself. And sometimes I'm comfortable with the answer, and sometimes I go, well, you know, I could have handled that conversation better. I had a student come in from right after the election who she's Syrian American. She grew up in a small town, went to high school in a small town in Virginia. She stood there in she sat in my office with me. And this was actually Wednesday. It was right after, I had office hours the day after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a completely strong and stern posture and a stoic face. And she described the taunting, almost harassing text messages she was getting from people with whom she went to high school.
Really?
About the election. And these were not people she engaged with, you know, that frequently. I don't know. Maybe she had some sort of back and forth. But like, you know, she's just trying to make her way in this country, right?
Yeah.
She's just trying to make her way through the university. Super, super capable student who's, I'm sure, going to go on to great things. She did not need this in her day. Not that any of us do. But these people couldn't help but taunt her about this. I got a taunting text from one of my best friends who lives far away. And it included a deeply misogynistic, you know, phrase in there, you know, but the student was so strong and had put up with so much crap already. And you know that whatever relatives she has in Syria are going through much more than she ever has to deal with right now, right? If they're still in Syria, they might be in Greece, they might be in Bulgaria, who knows, right? And so she was not fazed. She was troubled. She was annoyed. She wasn't breaking down. I was holding back tears because I'm so much softer than she is, right? I'm 50 years old. I think I've been through some stuff. I haven't been through anything close to what she has in her life, what her family's gone through in her life. And she was getting many more troublesome taunts than I was. I got that one from some friend who should have known better.
Yeah.
Right. I had to check myself there and say, wait a minute, I got it. I'm pretty safe, right? No matter where I go, I'm a huge man. I have a funny foreign name, but I'm not marked that way in any obvious way. If you see me in the street, you know, I've dealt with my share of harassment and racism in my life, as many people have, but like, basically I'm doing okay.
Sure.
Right. I have no reason to be distraught. And the memory of this student's stern reaction and her strength has shamed me and strengthened me, right? So there's that. And then, you know, I have another friend who pointed out that she has a 103-year-old grandmother who's seen everything, who's not the slightest bit bothered by Donald Trump, right? So look, students aren't snowflakes. Many of them have gone through stuff that we would not wish upon our enemies. Students are students.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all kinds of different people, right? sometimes we're snowflakes because we're Americans, and Americans are pretty damn soft, you know? And I think this is the thing. Right now, we can no longer afford to be soft. And we all have to find our way, and we all have to find our thing. My thing right now is to write a book explaining how social media got us into this mess. Everybody else is going to find their own thing. It might mean defending an abortion clinic. It might mean going to a Unitarian church and helping out with some volunteering stuff, right? There are lots of different ways we're going to find our thing. We've all had trouble in the first few weeks trying to imagine what that thing is. But, you know, I can't help but take strength in my community, in my students, in my neighbors, in my family. And I think we're going to be okay in the long run. I'm very worried about the short run, but I'm confident about the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've been trying to, I'm not wearing it right now, but I have been wearing my safety pin around UVA, and it's made a difference. I mean, I've had, you know, at work and off work, and I've had like people come up and just kind of, you know, point or tap and say, thank you. You know, thank you for letting me know. Gosh, there's so many things I wanted to talk to you about. We could take into another hour.
I live here.
Yeah. about the film that you've been a part of. I wanted to talk about, you know, safe spaces brought up a whole another door about language and about words, phrases like how politically correct has become freighted with something that it's just not. I was having a discussion on Facebook with a relative the other day, and I'm sort of struggling to find a definition of politically correct because one of Trump's new appointees is going to be in charge of NASA, doesn't want NASA setting climate change because, and the quote was something like, because of all the politically correct results that
come. Oh, my God.
I know, right? It's what does that even mean?
You know what's politically incorrect? When Mar-a-Lago is underwater in 20 years, that will be politically incorrect, all right?
Or maybe laughing about it now is a little politically incorrect.
Oh, my. Well, you can only laugh sometimes. I mean, that's amazing. But look, you know, it's almost to the point where being polite to someone is trouble. Is that a bad thing?
Right. See,
Sesame Street lead us so awry.
That's my new definition of politically correct. And I want to stand on this is coming into a conversation, assuming that the other person has already earned respect and dignity.
Yeah.
And start there. And that's all it means. And what the heck is wrong with that?
Right.
And has this election now made it okay to just be rude?
It wasn't just the election is just the final victory lap of that movement. But that's what Fox News is all about, right?
It is.
That's what half of Facebook's all about.
Hey, I mentioned in passing the film that I went to the screening of. Remind me.
Starving the Beast.
Starving the Beast. Thank you. Which is about academia being sort of turned into like a corporation. Where does one find that?
I don't think it was playing at the Violet Crown. I actually haven't checked. I don't think it's playing there anymore. Fairly soon it will be available through various streaming services, and I'll definitely let you know, and you can let everybody know. But it ran in theaters in college towns all over the country over the past few months. It's a documentary that examines much more than any particular thing within higher ed. It examines the overall ideological threat and attack on public higher education, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas,
and of course,
Louisiana,
UVA.
And UVA are all the main characters. And it's a pretty stirring and frightening thing. And now we have, you know, people who will be running the Department of Education who explicitly hate public higher education, in addition to public education in general. Things are rough.
Please come back.
Sure.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. My guest, Siva Vaidyanathan. This is Sean McCord hosting the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.